often have a core of the same crowd, and then there are people who come from various disciplines and with various interests. I just wanted to let you know, firstly, I'm Jean Sherman, for those I don't know, and I don't know everyone in this audience, but what we do here at SCAF, at the Sherman Contemporary Art Foundation, is we have four projects a year. You're seeing two at the moment. The one outside, the Vietnamese Vo Trong Nia artist, some of you will have seen before. It's on until, it's up, not on, it's up until the 10th of December when we close for the summer break. And then inside is Greg Semu, the Samoan artist. And we've had Mikhail Subotsky, and we've had Jompet Kizwi Dananto, so an Indonesian and a South African who did a project with England and Australia, sort of connecting the two. So welcome to everybody. I want to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I don't like to say that, standard phrase that everybody says, because when you repeat something often enough, it becomes meaningless. So what we need to remember is that they were here first, and that they gathered on this space and around this space, the same space in which we celebrate our three architects this evening. So we pay tribute to them and acknowledge their presence, past and present and into the future. The Sculpture and Ideas, the Culture and Ideas project is an adjunct to the four projects we do, and we activate the space in dozens and dozens of different ways. This particular talk is in relation to the architectural series, Fugitive Structures. We've said we would do four, and we've done four, and they are, this is the last one. Two Australians, Andrew Burns and Robert Besson, ARMA, AR/MA, and then an Israeli group, and now Vo Trong Nia from Vietnam. And there's a beautiful little box set designed by our really wonderful, talented designer, Mark Gowing, that, good for a Christmas present if you're thinking of something different. It can be, it's a little metal box that holds the four architectural catalogues. We do a catalogue, a publication for every show. Now I'm going to introduce our speakers. I like the fact that they have chosen, there's Isabel Tolland, Amelia Holliday, and the urban strategist Michelle, and I would have said Michelle Tabet, but Tabet, you pronounce it with a T. It must have been a French name originally, I think. What is it? Oh, it's a Lebanese name. And would you pronounce it Tabet? In Arabic. I see. I wonder if there was a French influence in it somewhere. Because, you know, the French were there. Anyway, I'm just having a little private conversation, excuse me. But in the middle of the Isabel and Amelia's name, they've taken their middle names and called themselves Eileen Sage, which I think is lovely. It both references them and obscures them at the same time. I think that, they both are award-winning architects. They've won awards for various projects. Probably most of you here would know them better than I do. But certainly they've come into the public eye with the Venice Architecture Biennale, which is what we're going to talk about, or they're going to talk about this evening. It's quite interesting, you know, the Art Biennale started in the 1890s, 1895 I think it was, whereas the Architecture Biennale is only 15 years old. It's the 15th Architecture Biennale. So there's a huge difference between the two, 85 years before architecture kicked in. And I've got somebody coming to see me soon who's doing, under the umbrella of an ARC grant, which are these big government grants, doing a project, someone from Queensland, on where architecture sits now in the cultural spectrum. Because, and I mean, I'm one of like 1,000 people I'm sure she's interviewing, but it's about the Fugitive Structures Project, because so many architectural projects are finding their way into galleries now. And this is what this ARC grant is about. It sounds like a huge grant for a subject that hasn't got all that much mileage behind it yet. But anyway, we'll see what comes of it. I think the concept of the pool is absolutely brilliant. I mean, I'm sure that the jury that chose these three young women were absolutely amazed at how obvious the concept is on the one hand, and how it has never really been addressed in this way on the other. So you'll hear much more about it. And I've been in Venice many times, 14 or 15 biennales, art biennales, only one architectural biennale, and I know how hot it is at that time of year. And to see some of the images of people sitting and dangling their feet in the water, all I can say is it must have been the great attraction of the biennale, because everybody is perishing with the heat, and here's a haven. So it's not only a symbol of the Australian psyche and democratic leisure environment, but it's also a balm for aching hot feet. So they'll tell us a bit more about it. I just wanted to talk about Isabel for a minute. She and Amelia came together in 2013 as a firm, but they'd worked together previously since about 2008. Very interestingly for me and us here at SCAF, Isabel worked for Shigeru Ban in Paris. And wait for some news about Ban coming up soon in mid-November. I'm not going to spoil everything by making announcements, but I'm hinting. So her award winning projects with the Castle Crag House. I haven't seen any of these projects. Prince Alfred Park, an upgrade. And she's also married to an artist, Jasper Knight, whose work I know. Eileen is a university of New South Wales medalist. They both medalist, actually. Worked for Tonkin Zalaika, and very close friends, especially Brian Zalaika, who's married to one of the artists that we've worked with, Janet Lawrence, for many years, and Neeson Merkitt, and also Sam Marshall, you would know from the MCA Extension and other wonderful projects, award-winning projects at Whale Beach and various other places. I'm not going to go into their histories now. And Michelle, in any detail, but I want to give you a sense of how three young women have really broken through not only a glass ceiling, but some serious barriers, because architecture was seen as a male domain in the same way as finance and engineering and all sorts of other professions. And to have three young women representing Australia at the Venice Architectural Biennale is something. Michelle is an urbanist. The whole notion of urbanism is a very important one. Michelle knows much more about it than I do. But we do know that people are moving at a rapid rate from the countryside into the cities. And therefore, one of the main goals of the 21st century is to make the cities more livable than they are, and also able to cope with all these people, how to best, get around that problem. It's one of our key questions. The key question, I think, of the 21st century, and I'm sure I can't imagine anyone would disagree, is what to do about the 60 million refugees that are floating around the world, many of whom have no hope of returning to where they came from. And that is, in a way, another urban question, because you are going to find many of these temporary cities or settlements or camps or refugee camps will become permanent, because they've got nowhere else to go. So what's to be done with them? And therefore, they are going to become cities or slums. They'll either become new cities, or they will become violent, unmanageable slums. And I think that's one of the key questions facing all of us in the 21st century. Australia's quite far removed from it in a way, but you only have to step into Europe and see what, you know, what is going on and how people are grappling with these problems. So that's all from me. I hope you enjoy the talk, and I'm very much looking forward to it. I know I'm going to learn a lot. How many people in the audience are architects? Raise your hands. About a third. Are you not sure? How many people are architectural students? No one. Okay, so we've got about a third of the audience are qualified architects. Right. I can sit here, can't I? Will I be able to see? Maybe I'll go back a little. Come on, girls, onto the... Here we are.
Great, thanks, Jean. Thanks, everyone, for coming tonight. So when we interviewed Paul Kelly for this project, he told us that the pool was a metaphor for life. And he said, as you move through life, it seems to be a series of steps into deeper and deeper water. What comes along in life are the things that we don't know, the things that everyone goes through but are not known until you do it yourself. The loss of the parent, the birth of the child, the beginning of love or the end of love, all those things. You don't know them until they happen to you. It's all deep water when you get there. I guess that life is a series of risks. The bigger risk is standing at the edge and not going in. And we also felt that this story was really a metaphor for our participation in this project, a moment in our careers where we really stood at the edge and dived in. Because in January 2015, the Australian Institute of Architects held an open national competition for the role of the creative director of this year's National Australian Exhibition at the Venice Architecture Biennale. So a role that was really coveted amongst the architectural profession, but also one in the past that had been won by much more established practitioners and definitely much more well-known practitioners. So as many of you know, Venice is this amazing kind of backdrop. It's one of the most spectacular settings in the world. And having been to Venice now a couple of times over the last few years, I really love sort of wandering through the back streets and getting lost in these sort of piazzas that aren't necessarily identifiable on maps. But it's also every second year, as Jean was saying, the host to the Venice Architecture Biennale, which is one of the most prestigious and largest gatherings of architecture in the world. So whilst the Art Biennale runs in odd years, the Architecture Biennale runs in even years and uses the same venues, but is sort of slightly less well known and is sort of building a sort of a following over the last 30 years. So as you can probably imagine, exhibiting in this environment was also always going to be a very daunting prospect. And I actually had to convince Isabel right at the beginning of this process that we should even put in a submission to the Institute of Architects. She felt that we were just starting a practice. We also had young children. And obviously I told her, don't worry, we have absolutely no chance of winning. Because, but actually it would be very good practice for sort of future competitions we might want to enter. And also sort of for just for the future when we might actually have a chance. So at the beginning of the process, we really began a discussion about what we wanted to say about Australian architecture in Venice. So, and we began really by reflecting on what it meant to exhibit architecture. And this is something, obviously, with the SCAF Foundation have looked into as well. Because there's this, always this question with exhibiting architecture as to how do you mediate between the real world of buildings and then the sort of representational world of the gallery. And how do you engage, I suppose the secondary question we had was how we would engage professionals and then non-professionals alike within this discussion. So in Venice, we were really very interested in telling a story about architecture rather than profiling particular projects or particular sort of famous Australian architects or even non-famous Australian architects. We're really interested in telling a story. So we saw the pool as this particular Australian public space. We felt it's our version of the piazza in Europe. But also is this sort of diverse and engaging architectural gesture. It's an incredibly seductive object. Come and sit down the front. And And also this amazing repository of kind of stories and associations. So we really felt when you look into the pool, you see yourself reflected back. It also speaks, and this is an amazing aerial photo of Wylie's baths in Coogee, and we also felt it speaks to this sort of man-made and natural edge, so the moment between architecture and something found. And it also speaks to the relationship between architects and non-architects. So those that we felt may feel like they don't have something to add to a conversation about architecture, and yet we felt they all had an emotional connection to this place. This is the Australian Women's Weekly pool cake. And this was one of the first images we showed the jury, and they probably thought we were a little bit mad. But we really felt, and still do, that it sums up a lot of our intent. Not too serious, playful, and full of references that both architects and non-architects have this nostalgic connection to. So many, many people have told us that this was the cake that they always wanted and never got, or that the cake that they got and then it melted, or that they spent many hours making this cake for their children or their grandchildren in the 80s. So we really felt this dialogue and this two-way exchange between architects and those that inhabit their projects was really central to what we were trying to do, and really summed up in some ways in this image. Because we wanted architects to listen to what others had to say about public space and the experience of architecture. And this meant asking architects to remove their architect goggles, to drop the archi speak. And this was really one of the successes of collaborating very closely with Michelle, who, as Jean points out, is not an architect. She's an urbanist, but she's really a design advocate. And Michelle always reminded us to speak in a language that other people could understand. Architects often like to sort of hide what they're trying to say around sort of design language. And she really reminded us to drop that and talk about stories, not just projects. So how Isabel and I, as native Sydney-siders and as architects, collaborated with Michelle, who you'll hear from her accent, is not originally from Sydney. She has a very international background, and was really very central to how we worked on this project. Because Isabel said, and I feel in our work, that unusual and unexpected collaborations have become something of a calling card. And even though we're only a few years old, this is something we've really tried to explore in lots of our work. So for this project, it included a very close collaboration with Bree Van Rijk, who's quite an amazing, accomplished composer and experimental percussionist. So you might have heard the soundtrack that she composed for our project in Venice as you were having drinks outside or as you were taking your seats before. So Bree really picked up on the sounds and reverberations of a pool environment and translated these sort of architectural gestures into this sort of amazing soundscape of emotive references. Because through the project, we're also interested in placing architecture within a sort of broader cultural landscape. And a key part of our brief from the Institute of Architects was that the exhibition and the curatorial approach sort of needed to celebrate and augment the experience of the new permanent Australian Pavilion in Venice. So this was just opened in 2015 for the Art Biennale and was designed by Melbourne architects Dent and Corker Marshall. So we really conceived of our project as an architectural intervention within this building, and our site was the white interior of the newly designed pavilion. So the building itself has this beautiful relationship to the canal. We're actually the only pavilion with a view and a window onto the canal. And we have this fantastic deck, which I'll get to a little bit later, that opens up across into this setting and really draws in the setting of the Giardini, which is where all the national pavilions are located in Venice. So the national exhibitions are all in some way a commentary about national identity. Really a statement about cultural output. But we felt it was very important in our project that Australia's presence in Venice not be some form of trade show, which has been a default position of some national exhibitions in the past. So we really felt being the first exhibition, architecture in the new pavilion, was also quite a challenge. As I said, the building was only just finished, and not really, almost quite finished, in time for Fiona Hall's opening last year. And so no one could really tell us how it worked. People actually couldn't really tell us how big it was. We had check measurements coming back, sort of confirming different sizes against the plan. But we tried to also turn this challenge into also one of our biggest opportunities. Because, of course, if there's no one to tell you what you can do in the space, there's also no one to tell you what you can't do in the space. including our proposal, which was to put a pool of water in the centre of the gallery and let people swim around in it. What could possibly go wrong? So because much to the Institute's, the terror of the Institute's legal team, it wouldn't be a pool if you weren't allowed to go for a swim. So we wanted people to be able to engage in the water in all the ways that they wanted to. And this included the frivolous, sitting by the edge, chatting with friends, splashing, letting your kids go for a swim and dangling your feet and wading across. But it also included asking our audience just to sit a little while and to look at the surface of the water and to reflect and to engage in all the stories that we'd collected. Because we're also very conscious of the visitor experience, of the Biennale as a whole. So for those of you who have been there, it's a bit like visiting 60 museums in one day. And this can be a total cognitive overload, even for the most dedicated. So we wanted our exhibition to be a moment of repose, a place to reflect and to enter a space that's intuitive and reflective and experiential, rather than something that's didactic or dense with information. And these chairs, which sit at the entry to the exhibition and also within the exhibition space itself, were really designed for specifically for this purpose. So they're called the Anella Nem chair, which translates as sit a little while in the Central Australian Arundé language. And they were a collaboration with Elliot Rich, who's a Alice Springs-based industrial designer. And they were fabricated by the Centre of Appropriate Technology, which is in an Indigenous training and enterprise workshop in Alice Springs, and shipped then all the way to Venice. So we really felt this canal side platform where the chairs were was really very important in the context of the Biennale, and this was us during the install having a lunch break, because we're really one of the only pavilions that have this type of space, and I really felt that it was like, it's amazing, sort of very Australian outdoor room that welcomes visitors to our exhibition and to this little piece of Australia within Venice. So during our time in Venice, we also came to see the Biennale as really itself an open platform for exchange. So the Architecture Biennale specifically is not a sort of highly organised, tightly curated show. It's really much more a place of opportunity where our project would sit alongside of others and dialogue with other national and international contributions, but also adding just to a conversation and discussion about the nature of architecture in 2016. So this year, the overall, for those who don't know, the overall Biennale creative director was Alejandro Aravena, a Chilean architect, who was also this year's Pritzker Prize winner, which for those, again, who don't know, is the equivalent of the Architecture Nobel Prize. So Aravena, in his home country of Chile, has a strong reputation for socially engaged architecture. So projects that benefit the many, not just the few. And this was something that he would reflect in the overall theme. So when he announced his theme, Reporting from the Front, he chose to use this image of Maria Reich to illustrate. So Reich was a German archaeologist, and she spent much of her life studying the Nazca Lines in Peru. And by raising herself on top of the ladder, she got this amazing view and gained a new perspective, turning the random marks on the ground into birds, trees and flowers. She used the ladder to get a better vantage point onto the large-scale geometric marks on the desert floor. So Aravena said, "We would like the Biennale Architecture 2016 to offer a new point of view, like the one of Maria Reich has on the ladder. Given the complexity and variety of challenges architecture has to respond to, reporting from the front will be about listening to those that were able to gain some perspective and consequently in a position to share some knowledge and experiences with us standing on the ground." So for us, this curatorial statement was really about architecture that improves the quality of life. Architecture that responds in multiple dimensions, in time, and resonates with people both in and without of the profession. So we also thought it's important to point out that architects are not always the people on the ladder. They're not always the best place to share these innovative and new special perspectives. Non-architects are in fact equally well placed to comment on the built environment and the places that we live our lives. So whilst our project was actually selected before the announcement of this theme, we're very excited about the fit that our project might have with this sentiment. And we're interested in reporting a story about the pool as a highly valued public space in Australian culture, a space of social interaction and engagement, a great leveller of difference. So the pool, of course, also suggests to people a project about affluence and excess. And we're also interested in the dialogue between these two sentiments. Australia is the lucky country, but also a place where some are not as lucky as others. So I never realised learning to swim as a child is a privilege. It's something that myself and many Australians take for granted. And as part of our research, and right at the beginning of the process, we launched a national call out for pool images and references and stories. And many architects and others shared with us these amazing images of pools from all around Australia via Instagram and email and other means. So one particular series of images really stood out to us. And these aerial images, they captured all the beautiful colours and the forms and the edge condition all around Sydney and the New South Wales coast, including amazing images of Bondi and icebergs, and this beautiful one of Clovelly Bay enclosure, which we actually included to the entry of the exhibition in Venice and also as the cover of our book that some of you might have seen outside. So the photographer of these images, we discovered, was a young recent architecture graduate from UTS, Abdul Moez, who's actually here tonight, which is lovely. So originally from Pakistan, now living in Sydney, we asked Abdul to share his story with us as to why pools were such an inspiration to him. So he told us, and I quote, "Since moving to Sydney in 2012, I have immersed myself in the city with the ambition to explore and understand what it's like to be a Sydney-sider. As a child growing up in Pakistan, I was always quite curious about different spaces I'd only really see referenced in books, video games, or on television, such as pools, gyms, bars, theme parks, and art galleries, all places where groups of people enjoyed being together. My first experience of the ocean was last year when I visited a friend in the Royal National Park, and it was the first time I tasted seawater. From this day, I was curious to how people enjoyed the water and what I could learn from their experience around the pool. So I decided to use pools as my starting point. I use this more as an excuse to enjoy the pool facilities rather than to swim, as I still do not know how to." Abdul's story reminded us that the pool is not only about swimming. We feel that above all, it's a social space, a space where the personal and the communal intersect, a place around which we can sit and all share our stories. Thank you.
Thanks, Amelia. Can you all hear me? I bet you were all expecting some sort of heavy Lebanese accent after that conversation. I mean, you're a little bit disappointed, but I think you'll live through this one. So Amelia's really kind of set out the ambition of the Biennale as a kind of a global get together for architects and others. My focus is really going to be on talking you through our process of collecting the stories and developing a curatorial approach. And I'll start here, which is a slide that we've put together that kind of represents a little bit of each one of us and shows that we've come together as a team, but really with really diverse interests. And when we started the research, once we kind of nailed the idea that we were going to do the pool, we all went in our own directions and scavenged and hoarded and everything from, you know, documentaries to video clips to newspaper articles and books, and obviously architectural images. Obviously, how could I forget that? Song lyrics and poems, and we're really kind of very taken by the fact that the pool in itself had this large cultural footprint, larger than we had anticipated, actually. We probably had an intuition for it, but it was much larger than we had anticipated. And so from this, actually, from this kind of scavenging and research, we really figured out that the pool... We weren't necessarily going to find only lovely examples of architecturally designed pools. We were actually going to find pools that were tied to personal stories and to stories sometimes of national relevance. This image is actually the kind of the victory moment. It's so beautifully captured in this vintage image from Fairfax, actually. It's the victory moment when Charlie Perkins, the Indigenous rights leader, as a student from Sydney Uni, along with other students from Sydney Uni, hopped on a bus and went to central New South Wales. And as they went through the different towns in central New South Wales, they were trying to do kind of stage actions that would highlight the fact that, you know, know, Indigenous people were living in very racially segregated conditions. And in this moment, after having pleaded with the gate, with the pool attendant at the Moree Artesian Baths, he actually busted through the gates with this group of children and let them in the water on a really hot day. And this episode and the way it's captured in this photo for us is really kind of that poignant moment where it says, where it really challenges that status quo. And a lot of people would argue that this moment in 1965 is really one of the many precursors, and it doesn't, it didn't change everything, but it's one of the many precursors that led to the referendum into Indigenous rights in the 70s. So what we found out from this really was, obviously there's moments of national significance that played out in the pool, but also that some of these stories are not going to be ours to tell. Neither Isabel, Amelia, or I were around in 1965, and that we were finding that there were people who were, actually, and who had a much better relationship to that. And so if, and that really solidified our position as creative directors. Maybe the idea wasn't that we tell people what we think about pools. Maybe the idea is that we provide a platform for others to do so. And that was the big insight. Some pools, like this one, which is the Fitzroy Baths in Melbourne, are really culturally significant. You know, they're the backdrop to a lot of cultural output. So some of you might know it from the references in Helen Garner's Monkey Grip. And for those of you who don't read that much, it's also in the opening sequence of Channel 10's Offspring. And it's also the title of a song by Courtney Barnett. And so this pool is... to us, obviously, it's culturally significant to people from Melbourne because, in a lot of ways, it's a symbol of a changing Melbourne in the 50s and 60s. So, the sign, the Danger Deep Water Aqua Profunda, really encapsulates this. The pool manager in the 50s and 60s, I can't remember the date exactly, just noticed that there was an influx of children coming to the pool from an Italian background, from recent migrants who probably didn't either read or write in English very well. And trying to remediate the fact that a lot of them were getting trapped at the deep end and crying for help, he asked a friend of his, well, will you help me actually put a sign up that says Danger Deep Water? So it's a little bit of DIY culture and a little bit of bad translation ended up in Aqua in Latin and Profunda in Italian. And despite the error, this sign is now heritage listed, so there's no getting rid of that. But we found that what was interesting about this, and whilst this photo is actually quite beautiful, is that, you know, this project isn't particularly architecturally sophisticated. It's probably, you know, some areas are quite mundane and functional. But great architecture is really architecture that has great stories. This is a completely different pool. This is Ian Thorpe Aquatic Centre. I'm sure some of you have been there. And the reason why we were so kind of drawn to it, beyond the fact that the architecture is quite compelling in this case, is that this was the backdrop to the writing by Anna Funder. She wrote an article in 2010 for The Monthly called Water Gods. And in this one short piece of writing, it fit on a spread in The Monthly, she kind of described the way in which the pool here was really an inclusive space. It had a cradle-to-grave sense of inclusiveness. And so at the time, at the time she was writing this, she was quite heavily pregnant, the way I am, but she already had two kids, and two of the kids were swimming around in different classes for different kids of different abilities. There were senior citizens, there were children with disabilities, and she really felt like that's a quite unique feature of the pool that you don't necessarily find in other places. She also found that it connected to the sense of spirituality that we have, and that perhaps in an increasingly secular society, the pool is taking on some of those functions that we used to attribute to places of worship. And so what was really interesting from that, we just kept going back to this piece of writing and said, oh, it's just so brilliant. And we just realized, and we just looked at these photos and we're like, but this is a photo, as all architectural photos, it's completely empty and devoid of people. So it's not really telling the story. And we should be okay with the idea that some of architectural photography, drawings, and models is not always going to tell the whole story. So we embraced that. And that's how we kind of accepted the fact that we were going to include things like poems and writings and so on, because they capture the story more fully. So this is, and we thought, you know, this makes us look really crafty, and we actually, you know, but we did, you know, it came to a point at some point in September 2015, so a little bit over a year, where we'd done all the scavenging, we'd done all the, you know, collecting of materials, some good, some not so good, and we had to find some sort of structure for this. So how do you do that? You know, how do you find a way of telling stories that has some sort of, you know, it has to have an arc. People relate to an arc in a story. So we worked hard together to actually figure out, you know, what were kind of the emerging themes that we were seeing. And then, this is all Isabel, actually, who actually, beautiful handwriting. And actually then, out of these themes, who could we match, you know, just true to that idea that we were not the master narrators, who were people that the audience would want to hear from? Who could we match with the idea of, you know, talking about the scale of the continent? And funnily enough, we came up with 8 people that we wanted to approach to interview for our book and talk about the pool. We were going to ask them, you know, what were your past associations with the pool? What did it mean for you in the past? What function do you think it fulfills? And what is the potential of the pool for the future? And funnily enough, we didn't land on any architects. Everybody was from the creative industries in general, you know, writers and so on, and fashion designers, and some people were sports people, obviously. But we felt really comfortable with the idea that you didn't necessarily need to have architects to tell the story of architecture. I'm going to talk you through the 8 people that we worked with, but before I do that, I should have a note that portraiture was really important for us in this, in the way that you kind of capture the soul of someone. All the portraits we've included in the book, with the exception of this one, were shot by our dear friend Brett Boardman, who's an architectural photographer, but also a portrait photographer and a performance photographer. Unfortunately, Tim was too busy, so we had to use this amazing photo of him in the bush on the Hawkesbury River. But all the other ones will be by him. So, Tim Flannery. Obviously, you know, renowned kind of activist, environmentalist, but from a background in paleontology and geology. And so what we wanted to hear from Tim really was, what's this particular relationship that Australians have with water? What is it about the way that the continent has been put together through millennia that means that we have this particular relationship? And to Tim, really, what's interesting is that for him is, we have an unnatural relationship with water as, you know, kind of European descendant Australians, and that there's a lot to learn from the way in which, you know, water is managed and its temporality through Indigenous culture. And he actually doesn't like brackyard pools at all. He finds them unnatural, and he converted his into a frog pond. I don't need to introduce this guy, but for those of you who don't recognize him because of his sunnies, this is Ian Thorpe. And when we're thinking about, you know, who we might put together for this book, we were really conscious of the fact that the pool actually plays out at different scales. It plays out at the scale of your body, but it also plays out at the scale of the continent, you know, the Great Artesian Basin being the biggest pool. So we were approaching, we were thinking, oh, who could really tell us about that kind of deep sensation of swimming, and who knows how to swim well, and that was not me. So we approached him, and very interestingly, at first he was like, but I know nothing about architecture. I was like, oh, don't worry, it's not really about architecture. And it turns out that someone like Ian has like this kind of sonar sixth sense in sensing a water environment, hearing underwater, understanding the kind of conditions around him, but also exploiting the water to be a collaborator for his performance, and he really talks about it in those terms, in terms of a performance. So that was really the conversation at the scale of the body. These guys, this is Anna Plunkett and Luke Sales from Romance Was Born. They're a fashion design duo, completely off the wall. You know, I think some of the best creative talent that we've got in Australia, to be perfectly honest. And the two of them are from rural New South Wales. One is from Maitland and the other is from Albury. We photographed them here at Prince Alfred Park Pool, one of their favorite hangouts. And what's really amazing about the way that they work is that so much is based on their childhood memories, and therefore so much is based on the pool, because they spent countless hours as kids, you know, jumping in and around the pools because they were from places where there wasn't that much going on in the summer. For them, it's really about these childhood memories and bringing those to life through their work, but also through the interview that they did with us. This is Christos Tsokas, the author of Greek background, Melbourne-based. We photographed Christos. This is a drone photograph that Brett cooked up in a backyard pool, just kind of a random backyard pool. But Christos is really a commentator on multicultural Australia and the way in which these kind of really complex questions of identity. That's been reflected in a lot of his award-winning work. We wanted to talk to Christos about the pool as this kind of symbol of having made it, and what that meant amongst the migrant community, like the Greek community that he comes from. But very quickly, he kind of contrasted that with the potential of the pool as a community space and what that meant in an increasingly multicultural Melbourne. I thought, you know, there was a... there's a real different kind of insight. And he was really talking about the scale of the suburb and the scale of the city. We then spoke to Anna because we noticed her writing and we just couldn't get away from it. And we decided, let's photograph you at Ian Thorpe Aquatic Centre. Anna Funder obviously had just come back from New York. She'd lived in New York for 2 or 3 years. And having come back, for her, one of the big insights is that pools are very different in the US. In New York especially, where she was living, there's kind of these pressure valves for a stressful urban environment, you know, a place that doesn't forgive or doesn't have any connection with nature, really, this kind of big concrete jungle. And for her, you know, it was really a reminder coming back after having been away for a couple of years that the pool is really connecting Australians to their sense of well-being, and that's a really important cultural trait. We then spoke with Hetty Perkins. So Hetty Perkins is the daughter of the late Charles Perkins, so the man who actually participated in the Freedom Rides in 1965. Hetty is an Indigenous art curator, previously at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, but also, the story of the Freedom Rides and the episode in Moree is kind of in her arsenal and in her heritage, you know, the way Indigenous people really hang on to their stories and kind of cultivate them. Hetty has supported many projects of pools in remote areas, so in Indigenous communities that often self-fund and self-build pools as this really important platform for those communities, for those remote communities. And to her, really, the pool is about this really simple thing, you know, for all Australians, then we should all have the equal right and access to leisure. And leisure, it might seem frivolous, but it's actually a fundamental right. This is Shane Gould, a very accomplished Olympian. She competed in the 1972 Olympics in Munich. But Shane is also spoke to us a little bit about the legacy of pools. So we spend millions and millions building pools for Olympic Games, but then when it comes to justifying keeping a pool open for council, somehow we can't see the social value anymore. And since retiring, she's become an avid student. She's got I don't know how many degrees, and she's currently doing a PhD at Melbourne Uni around the idea of the social capital in pools and what that means and how you actually convert that. How do you, how do you give that a monetary value? And to her, what's more important almost than the water is really the way in which people share the space around the water. And Paul Kelly, last but not least, he was really talking about the pool as this broader metaphor for life, being the ultimate singer-songwriter, Australian singer-songwriter. He just had this delightful way of talking about the pool as a personal and a collective frontier. And the way in which, you know, you explore yourself and you explore your family and your relationships by going to places like the pool. So that's our lineup, really, the way that it played out. And we were really incredibly honoured to be able to work with all these people. And here we go. I've got my prop. This is came to be, first and foremost, the way that we organised the book, which I encourage you to have a look at. But also, so what we decided was that each one of these people would start the chapter, and then it was our role at curators to kind of weave in a collection of references, whether that was, you know, a poem or a photograph or so on. But that was our curatorial gesture, was to let someone open the chapter and then choose the appropriate material and weave in those stories. But also one of the things we noticed was that there's actually a real potency in the experience that we had speaking to these people, and the audio was also going to be really important. So we worked with a radio editor who'd done a lot of work with Radio National, but also NPR in the US. Her name's Kate Montague, and with her we basically pitched to Radio National, hey, how about you take our stories? And so Radio National have our 8 podcasts where you can actually hear the voice, their emotion, the sadness, the joy of talking about the pool of the 8 people that we worked with. And this is on the Pocket Docs website, which is part of Radio National. And I think what's really interesting with this whole project really is that these were the 8 stories that we came up with at this certain point in time. These are the people we spoke with, but this has continued without us. You know, this has a life in terms of collecting stories. This has a life that we don't control, and I think that's what's really exciting. And with that, I'd like to introduce Isabel.
Thanks, Michelle. So Michelle's explained to you essentially what our content was and how we collected and structured it. And of course, now the challenge was, how do we translate all of this incredibly diverse and dense information into a compelling exhibition in Venice? I think we're behind on the slide, sorry. There was another one here, which I'm not too sure. This was showing some of the diversity of information and the visual content, actually, of pools at different scales as well, and how it crossed different kind of cultural output as well. And then the kind of the sense of space as well in the pool, and how spiritual that can be, in fact. We had an introduction written by Margot Neal, who's actually the Chief Indigenous Advisor at the National Gallery in Canberra, and she wrote a beautiful piece about how significant pools are to Indigenous culture and have been for tens of thousands of years. They are the places that they come together, where they share stories and where they share knowledge. And that was a very important part for us to start with. Did you? Yes. This is actually in Western Australia. I always forget. We have so many images. I know it's in the front of the book. I should look it up for you. But it's called Cathedral Gorge, I think. Yeah. Yes, it was actually taken by an architect, and it was quite interesting for us, as Amelia mentioned, the way that we gathered a lot of content was actually doing a national call out. And a lot of architects did send us stories and images, and often they weren't of highly designed architectural spaces. They were places like this, and this is what architects and non-architects value alike. And it was really very interesting for us to see this, to see what images people shared with us. So this was our first visualization that we prepared for the project, which was essentially put together in a few days, as these things often are, because this was at competition stage and we really wanted to win the project. And we had a piece of writing that went with this to describe what we were trying to achieve through this space. But when Amelia and I first discussed putting in, she finally convinced me that we should put in a submission, we were very conscious that we didn't want to do what was typically understood as a classic exhibition of architecture with drawings or models or photographs. What we wanted to do was create a place, a singular place of architecture that presented a story about architecture and that understood itself as just one part of a much bigger whole, as a setting for the transfer of information through different forms of media, where the architecture itself was a distinct and active part of the content, not just a framework off which the content would be hung. And that was a key part for us and a key difference we felt. So the piece, the text that we wrote at the time of this this competition stage read, "We propose to explore the pool as a natural and artificial spatial device. As the central organising device of the exhibition, the pool becomes a platform for exploring the different meanings, roles, and symbolism of this form beyond and through the architectural." And we felt we really did remain true to this throughout the process. And this is where we ended up, with a few adjustments, as naturally happens throughout the design process. But essentially what we wanted to create was something very simple and pared back and singular, that was designed to feel inclusive and would draw people in, and included many abstracted references of many different aspects of many different Australian pools. As Michelle explained, the information and stories we'd collected was extremely diverse. And they're all very different subjective stories, but they were also very clearly interconnected through the powerfully singular lens of the pool. And so in the exhibition space, rather than translating this information in all its density onto the walls in text or in images, we decided to create a network of sensory triggers and devices that could transfer this information and encourage direct interaction with the pool environment that we'd created. And so through everyday actions that any of us might naturally do at a pool, such as reading the newspaper, so we provided a newspaper in the space which had various content, new from the book, but also new content too. So it was structured differently to the book. But we had a newspaper, we had the books, and then there were the interviews, the voices of the people in the space. So it was kind of like you were eavesdropping in on the people around you in the pool. So we had one speaker, essentially, there were speakers scattered throughout the space, and each speaker was dedicated to each person that we had interviewed. So you could sit next to Paul Kelly, for instance, on the poolside bench, or next to Hetty Perkins on the deck, or Christos Tsokas on the stepped bleachers seating. And their voices shift around the room in one singular dialogue, as if in conversation with each other, speaking across the pool from different corners of the room. But it was important to us to reference this. It was important too to us that the reference points for information transfer were not just these literal, you know, voices or text or images, but they were also in the sensory experiences of the space, from the feel of the water itself, the coolness of the space, and the scent overlaid. So we worked. The scent that we had within the space was developed by scent by artists and designers Lynn Balzer and Tony Perkins, who are based in Sydney, and it's the scent of petrichor, of the wet ground after a bushfire and rain. A scent which is very familiar to many Australians and triggers memories of hot, dry summers. In terms of the other reference points in the space, we drew on a large body of images that we collected throughout our research process from places we'd visited. We looked at the stepped and tiered seating conditions around pools and considered the relationship between them and the water. We looked at ways to draw people into the water and encourage them to engage directly with it through simple signifiers, such as a handrail and a step. We created opportunities to engage directly with the water's edge and considered the shape of the pool, its size and proportion, the reflective surface of the water and its position within the space and the spaces created around it. We considered the materials and conditions around many pool environments, from the poolside bench to the poolside lounge, that allows people to customise the space and change their point of view of the pool. And with the colours of the chair, we chose to speak of the Australian landscape, the blue of the water and the reflected sky, the red earth and the green of the dry, hardy, sclerophyll bush and the concrete edge. In our design, we also considered what kind of social space this might be for both young and for old, and how we might be able to encourage people to feel comfortable within the space, to sit, dangle their feet, or get in. We considered how traces of activity would be left around the pool and would dissipate over the course of the day. We considered colours in the space and the places they referenced, and what mood or atmosphere they would create. We identified generic signage you often see around pools, and also specific signage, such as the aqua profunda sign that Michelle mentioned. And we decided to include this in the space, which we knew was a bit of a risky move, to include a misspelt Italian sign in Italy. But we decided, after much debate, to keep it, because of the stories that this would trigger. We also considered how natural light might fall onto the water. This is the Melbourne Olympic Pool, one of the amazing projects that is also featured in our newspaper and book. And considered that specific relationship between the window and natural light and water in the space in Venice. We considered certain light conditions and how they would reference not only a multitude of pool environments, but also lead us back to Venice and the conditions all around you in Venice. And also then the specific context of the exhibition, of the space, of the new pavilion, looking out over the canal. And we considered how the light conditions would change within the space as people moved the water differently. Sitting within the space during Vernissage period and after, we were essentially anonymous within the space, which was very interesting for us to see how people reacted and how they interacted with the space. Some walked in and were either amazed or confused. Some asked where the exhibition was. They thought it might have been downstairs, perhaps, to which, of course, the pavilion attendants would very kindly tell them that this was the exhibition and they were, in fact, part of it. Some were intrigued by the pool and the sound and the light and would sit for ages in the space, in the chairs, moving around from the chairs or to the bleacher seats or to the edge of the pool. Some dangled their feet, took photos or read the newspaper. Some chose a place to sit and listen attentively and immerse themselves in the experience. Others also immersed themselves literally, diving in and swimming breaststroke across the length of the pool. Some waded in together, some embraced the communal experience, and others sought out a quiet moment to float on the water alone. Some engaged with the context, and others more with the content. Some just took the time to relax and take a break from the exhausting Biennale experience. And others decided to take a nap, this guy curling up next to Ian Thorpe. It's been very interesting for us to hear and see what people have thought and made of the exhibition since it opened, what stories they've shared with us and their experience there, and what stories about other pools it's triggered for them. When our very special guest, Ian Thorpe, arrived in Venice a few days before the opening to see the exhibition, and we had the privilege of showing him round the space before it opened, Ian walked in and he walked out immediately again. He was overwhelmed with anxiety. He said he was sure he could smell chlorine, and that for him triggered this immediate sense of anxiety and panic because he thought he was about to compete. And he wasn't too sure if he could go back in again. Once we had calmed him down and explained to him that actually there was no chlorine in the space because the pool is actually filtered through a filter and bromine solution, and the scent is actually something different, no, not at all chlorine, he was able to kind of come to terms with this fact and come back into the space. So when he was able to separate this kind of anxiety that he had initially experienced and was able to see it more as a spectator and observe, he actually reminisced with us about his childhood training days at a local pool, the local pool in southwest Sydney, at the edge of the national park, where the smell of bushfire was actually a very common backdrop to him for those fond training days. This was a great example to us of how the pool is able to trigger both negative and also very positive emotions at the same time. This is the complexity we feel and the richness of the pool. As a key part of the opening in Venice, we incorporated a ceremony that was led by Gambagna elder Auntie B. Ballingarry, where Australian and Venetian waters were mixed and offered back to the canal and to the site. For us, the pool is in many ways a symbol of offering back on many levels, on the personal, professional, national and international. The pool for us was about providing a space and a place for people to gather and share their stories. Looking back now and the feedback we've received and continue to receive about this project, it's been extremely rewarding for us. And it's been an incredible experience to have been part of. Not just for the fact that it's a very prestigious international event, but also perhaps more so, because of the relationships it's enabled us to make with so many interesting and inspiring people, and the stories it's enabled us to collect and share. And these stories have come from everyone who's visited the space or heard about our project. People come up to us every day and share a new story, you know, whether that be about learning to swim or embarrassing moments, perhaps, at their local municipal pool, flirtations with first loves or first kisses in well-placed stolen bushes around the local municipal pool, memories of momentous family occasions or of life-changing events. All of these things that have happened around pools. At the moment, we're actually in the process of confirming the format and location of the next version of the pool back here in Australia. So if you weren't able to experience it in Venice, and this was a big part for us, that we wanted to be able to bring this back as an experience for everyone else here back home. So we're very much looking forward to seeing how this project will grow and be adopted by an even broader community back here in Australia. Thank you.
Wow. Have you ever come across such accomplished speakers? I think the philosophy department at Sydney University might be happy to employ them. Wow, very wonderful, wonderful presentation. We had another wonderful presentation here. Our last talk was an Indonesian collector called Dr. Wiyu Wahono, who talked about his collection and how it fits in with the spirit of the times. So, you know, it's really fabulous. Girls, thank you so much, really. What a fabulous presentation from each one of them. Now, how much, I haven't got my watch on, how much time have we got? What time is it now? 7:35. So we've got, say, 15 minutes for questions, and then people would like to have a drink and get home to their other lives. Who's got the mic? Johnny has there. So usually I know more people in the audience, but please feel free. Come on, guys. You after that, really. And we won't go more than three or four questions. Yeah, use the mic because we podcast these things.
This might be a little bit morbid, but the whole thing, one of the main things as an architect is the safety around swimming pools.
Hmm.
I mean, you had Aqua Profonda, but you didn't touch on the pool fence or drowning. And I'm just wondering, was that intentional? Was that just a little bit... too sad to,
not at all. I suppose we didn't touch it in this, but in our, for instance, in our interview with Hetty Perkins, she actually spoke about a very, I suppose I tried to touch on that in terms of life-changing moments. They're not always positive ones, definitely. So, you know, Hetty talked about the fact that when she was quite young as a teenager, she was kind of the elder of the group of children, and her cousin actually jumped into the pool and drowned. Well, she dived in after him, but she was able to revive him, but he did. Yes, nearly drown, I should say. Sorry, not nearly drown. She was able to save him. So that was, you know, a very emotional event for her and has impacted on her. And it's quite interesting to hear her speak about the pool too, because I have young children. I get incredibly stressed and anxious around a pool still. They are learning to swim, and my elder one now can swim very well, but I still get very anxious. And it was nice to talk to her and listen to her. She does talk about how she loves being around pools, but she doesn't necessarily want to be in the pool. And I think that's a lot of how I feel too. She likes to be the one, sort of the lifeguard, watching out for people, and probably perhaps because of that very early experience for her. But it is this dichotomous experience a lot of the time. You're filled with anxiety, but also, you know, it's beautiful and relaxing at the same time. So it's a confusing space. And yeah, as I said, that's the richness of the pool though.
But my question, which I think was part of your question, is were there any requirements around this pool?
Safety, is that part of
it? Yeah. Elsewhere speaks for.
I suppose just in a more general concept, yeah. You know, it's becoming harder and harder as an architect to make a beautiful space when you've always got this safety requirement and the standards keep changing.
Right? Yeah, the pool in Venice is just under 300 millimetres, which means it's actually a decorative water feature, which meant we didn't have to have a pool. It also meant we didn't have to have a lifeguard on duty, which wasn't quite in the Institute's budget to have a full-time lifeguard for the 6 months opening in Venice. But also we were really interested in always how young kids would be able to go in safely, and part of that was looking at... the step and how we would design that to be something that was safe, that, you know, there was a handrail and that people could enter it into the pool. But we're very interested in the stories that we collected, that they weren't all positive. Actually, Ian Thorpe at the opening in Venice made this fantastic speech, but he also talked about how the swimming is the first, is the Olympic sport that, it's the only Olympic sport that begins with survival. And we kind of thought that was kind of an interesting moment as well, that it's about leisure, but it's also about survival, and it's kind of wrapped up into all those stories.
I came from a landlocked environment in Johannesburg, and, when I came to Australia, the first thing I did with my children was get them swimming lessons. Mm. Yeah. It was a very, because I felt every Australian child needs to know how to swim. So I think, it's so Australian that Johannesburg was 200 miles from the nearest coastline, which was in Mozambique. Any other questions, guys? Come on, we need at least three. Come on. Oh, very attentive, but very... there's a question there.
The project is run by the Australian Institute of Architects, as in they kind of project manage it, but they also take on the responsibility, I guess, to fundraise for it, so that there's no recurring budget. Like the Art Biennale has a $1 million or whatever plus recurring budget for their show at the Biennale every other year. So the Institute of Architects take it upon themselves to fundraise that through various different channels. There's sponsorship, donations, and some of the people who donated are here tonight, as well as a kind of, a program that engages practices, architecture practices, and they can give like kind of different levels of money to support it. And so that's really how it did, it worked. And we all had to get our hands a bit dirty and, pitch to everyone. If you knew us in the 12 months before, we probably would have asked you for some money. So that's how it works. And in a lot of ways, that also makes you so thankful of, people's generosity. And what they're able to give, and it creates a community around it as well. We had this group of lovely VIPs who had donated, and we were able to build some really good relationships with them, which was really fantastic.
Feeds into your client potential later. No, I'm over time, and that's not what you think about, but that's really what happened. The Art Biennale, when I first started going, which was 15 biennales ago, that's 30 years ago, had a budget from the Australian government of very little. We served wilted cucumber sandwiches that in the heat they weren't edible really, and wine that tasted like vinegar in paper cups, and no one came to our party. Every pavilion, National Pavilion, has a series of parties and dinners and so on. And over the years, the budget has grown, and I was for a while, and many other people have been followed, and even before, part of the Commissioners' Council for the Art Venice Biennale, and those were a group of people who put in quite a lot of money. And it's this now public-private funding. It's not possible to do anything good from the public purse alone anymore. And that's part of what we do here. It's not possible because the stakes are so high now, that it's the public purse is just not enough, not to do it at the level that we want to do it. So from those wilted cucumber sandwiches, it's quite a sophisticated gig now, the art thing, gorgeous wine, Cate Blanchett opening, people flown in, the whole gig. Come on, guys. Oh, here you are.
Thank you. It was so interesting. I'm thinking it would just be so lovely for communities to copy your idea, school pools, community pools, and have their own evenings or days where people can come in and tell their own stories about their experience at their pool.
What a great idea. What do you think?
quit our jobs and
well,
on the road.
Yeah, interestingly, I think it's funny, this is slightly left field, but we're doing some research at the moment about Bankstown, actually, Bankstown's area, and actually about the Arts and Cultural Centre there. And in fact, they have a poetry slam. This is why I'm thinking about stories and people telling about their stories. And the Arts Centre there is, in fact, the site of the original Bankstown Baths, which was one of the first Olympic pools in Australia. So they did, in fact, have a night about pools and talking about pools and people coming and sharing their stories, which was quite beautiful. But yes, we definitely think it's something that could be built on and brought to other institutions, and as you say, but yeah.
I have to tell you that I think that you'll never, this will be your point de départ. You'll never design anything else. There's so much material in this.